ancient being born in another life form. Imagine what it would be like to be an animal. Just pick an animal. Pretend that that's what you are, who you are. You can think only like that animal. You do only what that kind of animal does. Can you imagine it? Having limited intelligence, not being able to speak. And then come back to being human. Remember what it's like to have a human body and human intelligence. The ability to think clearly and learn the Dharma. Capabilities that an animal lacks. And really feel a sense of appreciation for this quality that you have. And within with human intelligence. But being a human isn't sufficient. We could have been born with defective senses or great handicaps, which would make it more difficult to practice. But for some time, just imagine being blind or deaf or paralyzed or mentally retarded. And think, could I practice the Dharma? In those cases, would it be easy to practice? And really imagine having those kind of impediments. And then come back to being a human with healthy senses. And really rejoice at your ability to see and hear, to think clearly, to be able to remember and associate things. And a sense of real appreciation for that opportunity. But being a healthy human being is sufficient. What if we were born in a place where it was impossible to meet the Dharma? Imagine us being born in a country where there is no Dharma existing. There you are, you have this incredible spiritual yearning, a very strong wish to find meaning in your life, make your life valuable. But there's nobody around to learn from. There's no teaching. There's no book. Absolutely zero that can speak to your spiritual yearning. Imagine being born and living in that kind of environment. What would that be like? and now remembers the environment that we live in, where there's so much Dharma around. We're able to meet teachers, to have a supportive community, to have books. Really appreciate that ability to encounter the Dharma in the place where we live. And just having the Dharma in the environment isn't sufficient. We need also the freedom to practice. And so easily we could have been born in a situation where there's no freedom to practice. There are places in this planet where if you try and practice, you could get shot or thrown in prison. Where it's dangerous to meet as a group to learn the Dharma. It's dangerous even to be caught with your mouth moving to say prayers. What would it be like to live in that situation? There is no freedom where the Dharma is there, but if you were caught with a book, if you were caught meeting together, if you were caught meditating, you could be imprisoned or shot. What would that be like? And then come back to our present situation where we have freedom. There's not only freedom to practice, but freedom from fear. Where we can practice openly and not be afraid for our life, for our family, or anything by practicing. And so really appreciate this freedom that we have. Now with this very deep sense of appreciation for having a human body and having human intelligence, for being healthy with all our senses intact, for being in a place where we can contact the Dharma, where there's teachers and a supportive community and books, and where we have the freedom to be able to practice it and learn as we wish. Really have a strong appreciation for that, then develop an aspiration to really use the opportunity, not to waste. So easily hindrances can come, but right now we're free of them. Develop a strong aspiration to really take the essence of the present opportunity, the present time that we have to practice. And the best way to really take the essence from a precious life is to generate the altruistic intention, the aspiration to become a fully enlightened Buddha, to develop our potential completely, eliminate all hindrances, so that we can be of the most effective service to all other beings. Appreciate that we have the opportunity to really become a Buddha in this lifetime and generate the aspiration to do so. So what happened in the meditation? Hello?
That was a cow.
Yeah? And what was it like to be a cow? Quite dumb. It's incredible when you think about, you know, make your mind into a cow's mind. What's that like to be? Kind of amazing, isn't it? See, contrast that with being a human being. Were people able to develop some sense of appreciation? Were you all falling asleep? It might have been that you didn't feel terribly successful with the appreciation, but maybe there was something there nonetheless.
Yeah.
But try it some more, you know, when you go home. And like you said, you don't know what a hamster or a snake thinks, if it, you know, feels. But really try and imagine. I mean, imagine being like in a snake's body. Yeah? You know, I mean, you're just sitting there slithering under some stones. That's your whole life. That's your whole realm of existence. It's just, you know, big stones and grass and a few bits, you know, to chomp on. Well, what do you think about all day? What do you do? You know, how many lifetimes have we lived in cyclic existence with that kind of body and mind? And we might feel like it's hard to imagine, but remember when you were a kid and you used to play at being all these different things? So it's very much that same kind of feeling as when you were a kid. We used to be able to imagine being all sorts of things as a kid and play at it. So call up that same creative imagination.
Yeah.
You can enjoy what? Yeah, I mean, you'd think, well, you know, you just lie there, you know, soak in a lot of teachings. You know, he comes to more class than anybody else. Yeah. But then, are you waking up? but then, imagine having that mind, and in one hand you think, oh, it's not so bad, you know. But then on the other hand, you know, you might not be experiencing direct physical suffering, but you know something about karma. And so even though, like I said, the cat may not realize what's going on, you realize that, you know, there's virtually no opportunity to create positive karma. You know, you just live that. I mean, he has this great life, he has good company and good food, you know, very difficult. He gets some Dharma teaching imprint on his mind. He has very fortunate rebirth. He hears the Dharma. But, you know, most cats don't live in a Dharma household. Yeah. And then what happens? You know, all day long, maybe they eat and sleep. They use up some good karma. And then all the negative karma just festers. And then they create more and more as they go out and catch birds and bite spiders and kill all sorts of things. And so the minds are totally obscured, no opportunity to prepare for future rebirth, no opportunity to liberate themselves from cyclic existence. Yeah. And so when you realize the long-reaching implications of that it might be nice to lie in the sun, but the long implications of being a cat lying in the sun is that you just go one rebirth to the next in the hell realms and the hungry ghost realms and all these different realms totally without control. It's difficult. I mean, they basically have to rely on imprints, positive imprints that they created, for example, when they were a human being, that are still there on the mind stream that haven't ripened yet, that hopefully will ripen at the end of this lifetime. Or through, you know, they get some positive imprint, like he does, from listening to teachings. You know, or doing circumambulation, hearing mantras, you know, things like that. But this is the whole thing. I mean, if we're born as an animal, you know, if we don't practice this lifetime, in the next lifetime we're born as an animal, how do we get out? What happens to us? I mean, it's very difficult at the end of a life as a cat to develop a positive thought and to die in a good space so that you give possibility for your positive karma to ripen. Very difficult. And when we really see that, you know, it's so easy to be born as an animal, so difficult to get out. And then it makes us really appreciate our present opportunity, kind of like it's a miracle. And then from there, a very strong aspiration comes that I don't want to fall in the lower realms again. I don't want to be born like that. That's making some sense? Well, it's putting good imprint on the animal's mind. It's not, you know, it's good imprint, but it's, you know, it's not kind of karma from the power of their own way of thinking or their motivation. It's still good for them. So you see how it's so important to really develop the appreciation, and at least this is just using this as an example, you know, one meditation as an example. How important it is to develop appreciation of the opportunities and qualities we have in our life, and from there to develop a strong aspiration not to waste it. Because we see if we waste it, we've really blown it, you know, big time. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like losing your job or a relationship breaking up. You know, if we blow it with this lifetime and wind up in a lower realm, you know, big trouble. So when we do that meditation, then a strong aspiration comes not to be reborn that way. And then that's what enables us to keep good ethical conduct and, you know, and to make an effort to learn the Dharma. When we don't have that appreciation, then when we don't have that aspiration, then we stay at home and watch part two of Dancing with Wolves, you know? Yeah, because we don't have the ability to put our life in a perspective of what we're doing now is creating cause for future life. So then we just waste, you know, so many opportunities, just waste it. And then the time of death comes, and then what do you do? You know, you can't take a time machine and go backwards. You know, we're just left there to experience the result of our own actions. So when we're talking about, you know, aspiration, you see how important aspiration is. Because if we don't have aspiration, then we don't make use of our life. And if we don't make use of our life, then we experience the result of not doing that. Okay. So really putting some effort, and you can see, like I explained last time, so many of the Lama meditations are really designed to help us create positive aspirations. And so that's why it's really important to do the longer meditation so we have those aspirations. and that's why, you know, I really like stress people getting a good foundation in these basic practices, because if we start to do all sorts of high practices but we don't have the proper aspiration, we're not, you know, those higher practices are not going to become virtuous, and we're not going to have the ability to sustain the practice. Because we'll go in and, you know, oh, I'm going to do this real high practice, but in the back of our mind is the aspiration of, you know, I want a big peak experience, I want a big rush, you know? And so then you get a rush a few times when you do it, but then you keep doing it, and, you know, you stop getting the rush, and then you go, well, you know, that's a drag, and then you stop your practice. So that's why, you know, it's so important at the beginning really to imbue our minds with this kind of appreciation and aspiration, because if that's real solid, then it becomes very easy to practice, and very easy to practice continuously. Making some sense to this? Mm-hmm. Okay. So the next of the five object ascertaining mental factors is appreciation. So I've been touching on this a little bit so far, but we'll talk about it more in depth now. So it's a distinct mental factor that stabilizes the apprehension of a previously ascertained object and cherishes it in such that it can't be distracted by anything else. Okay? So the more we understand something, you know, the more we're able to ascertain the object's qualities, then the more we're able to appreciate it and see it as worthwhile or valuable. And so this mental factor functions to cherish the object, whatever it is we're meditating on, for example, and hold that object to be just you know, what it is, just as we're perceiving it. And so it stabilizes our mindfulness on the object, and it helps us to create aspiration to develop it. Okay. So, you know, appreciation, we have to really look in our life and ask ourselves, what do we appreciate? And this sometimes can be really embarrassing when we look. You know, when we see what it is in our life that we really appreciate. Huh? Now, sometimes we appreciate people who can kick a football really far, and we think that's great, and we marvel over them and rave over them, but is this a valuable kind of appreciation that's going to, you know, is this a talent that it's worthwhile of our appreciation to go after, or is this a talent that really, you know, it's fine if other people have it, but do we need to put our mental energy of appreciation towards appreciating that? Is it valuable or not? As opposed to directing our appreciation elsewhere, directing our attention elsewhere. You know, like if we appreciate somebody who, you know, the ability to kick a football really far, then we're going to have an aspiration to develop that talent ourselves. So then we're going to put our energy into that way.
Could there be
different levels? Yeah, there's many different levels. And that's what I'm getting at, to let's look at the different things that we appreciate and see what's really valuable. You know, where do we have correct appreciation and where do we have actually misdirected appreciation? I mean, there's nothing wrong with appreciating the ability to kick a football, okay? That's not non-virtuous or anything, but you know, given that we have a limited amount of time and mental energy, is that how we want to gear our mind to develop that appreciation and consequently that aspiration? Okay. Whereas, for example, if we're able to think about the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha and appreciate their qualities, then we appreciate, you know, their ability to guide us. We develop some aspiration to follow their instructions, some aspiration to become like them. Because we are, I mean, we become what we appreciate, and we appreciate what we, you know, we become what we aspire to become very often, and we aspire to become something we appreciate. So we have to look at what do we appreciate, what do we believe in, what do we have conviction in, what do we hold as valuable, what do we cherish. And to really, you know, ask ourselves, you know, am I cherishing proper things? Am I appreciating proper things, worthwhile things in my life? Mm-hmm. Okay, so for example, like if we really think about the qualities of the Buddha, and, you know, the Buddha having eliminated all defilements, generated all good qualities. You know, you think of the qualities of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind, you know, that, you know, Buddha can appear in many different forms, you know, spontaneously to be able to help sentient beings. You know, and a Buddha's voice can really communicate with others and knows exactly what to say and the right time to say it and how to say it and, you know, what to do. And the Buddha's mind, you know, knows somebody else's level of mind and knows what they're interested in, knows how to explain things to them, really has compassion that doesn't fade away. And so when we think about these kinds of qualities of the Buddha, then we really appreciate those qualities. And then that sets the stage for faith to come in our mind and aspiration to come. And then effort, you know, enthusiasm for practice flows very easily after that. Same way with the Dharma, if we think about the qualities of the Dharma, you know, how it gives meaning to our life, how it gives direction, how it helps us explain the things that we experience in a way that makes sense, you know, and when we really appreciate that, you know, because you remember, you know, what's it like, you know, what was it like before you met the Dharma when you're sitting there kind of wanting happiness and you're wanting something to explain your life and there's nothing around except all these little philosophies that, you know, don't speak to your heart and seem really contradictory. At least this was my experience. You know, I don't know about you, but this was my experience. You know, tried all these different religions, and, you know, nothing made any sense, and yet there was this real strong yearning inside. And what do you do with that? You know, and then you meet the Dharma, and you see the qualities of the Dharma, and how it makes sense, explains your life, gives you meaning, gives you a direction, shows you how to do it, how to improve. Then you have a really strong appreciation of the Dharma. So then with that strong appreciation, our refuge increases, becomes much easier to practice. Okay, same with the Sangha when we meditate on their quality. Okay? So you see, I'm trying to relate this to the Lamrim meditation to show you how Lamrim helps you generate these qualities and how these qualities, so that, you know, as you're aware of these qualities, then when you do the Lamrim meditation, you'll be able to see, well, you know, is this the kind of attitude, you know, am I meditating properly? You know, am I generating this kind of appreciation when I think about these things? Yeah. Okay, so there's limitless forms of appreciation. Yeah, because we appreciate all sorts of things, don't we? We appreciate football, we appreciate rollerblades, we appreciate the man on the moon, we appreciate... So we have to see, like you said, there's different levels of appreciation. So one level is appreciation that is mistaken. Yeah. So, or mistaken or valueless, you know, where we appreciate things that really don't have any, you know, essential meaning at all. Or when we appreciate things that are actually incorrect, like when we hold wrong views. Or we appreciate, we appreciate wrong views, wrong philosophical tenets. You know, religious leaders that advocate killing people, or, you know, something like that. In other words, appreciations that are leading us, that are mistaken, or that just don't have any value. And then another kind of appreciation is appreciations that are realistic, okay? So here's where we appreciate correct views, you know, like when we think about the view of emptiness and we appreciate it, or we appreciate the doctrine of impermanence and we realize its truth and have some appreciation and respect for that, or when we appreciate the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha and want to generate them in ourselves and want to follow their example and their teachings. Or when we appreciate our precious human life and so want to make it meaningful and take the essence from it. Okay. So it's helpful to kind of look in our own mind and, well, what things do we appreciate that are actually mistaken, or what things do we appreciate that don't have much value, and what things do we appreciate that that are correct and what things do we appreciate that have value, and how can we decrease one and increase the other, and then really put our mind to do it, you know, train our mind, reform our mind, retrain our mind in this direction. Because that's the whole thing about Dharma, it's saying, you know, we actually have the ability to change, but, and we're going to change for sure whether we want to or not, but are we going to leave how we change just to this process of, you know, being on automatic to our previous karma, you know, depending what we encounter in our environment, or are we going to become an active agent in how we change and really direct it and guide ourselves? And the next mental factor, the next of the five object ascertaining mental factors, is memory or mindfulness, okay? So this one, you know, you hear a lot in Buddhist circles, mindfulness, mindfulness. And it's become an almost, you know, it's kind of used all the time, just, you know, mindfulness. And nobody really knows what it means, but we always talk about being mindful. So here we're going to get a definition, okay? And try and figure out what mindfulness really means. Okay, so it's a distinct mental factor that repeatedly brings to mind a phenomena of previous acquaintance without forgetting it. It doesn't allow the mind to be distracted from the object and is the basis for concentration. Okay, so there's three things about mindfulness. First of all, there's the objective feature. Okay, there's an object that we're familiar with. Okay, so we can't be mindful of an unfamiliar object. It has to be an object we're familiar with. So that's why, for example, when we meditate, we might use the breath as an object of concentration. It's a fairly easy object to become familiar with. Or when we use the image of the Buddha, and we've visualized image of the Buddha as our object of concentration, then we have to make ourselves familiar with that visualized image. So we spend some time looking at the picture. You know, you look at the picture of the Buddha and really concentrate on that, and then you can remember it, you can be mindful of it when you close your eyes. So, you know, the first quality of mindfulness, the first thing it depends on, is you have to have an object that you're familiar with. The second feature of mindfulness is the subjective quality, the subjective feature. So it's a forgetfulness within the observation of that object. So we have to be actually actively observing that object to be mindful of it and not forgetting it while we're observing it. Okay? So it's a subjective feature of the mind not forgetting it, mind holding it in retention. And then the third feature is that it functions, you know, it's a functional feature. And here mindfulness functions to prevent distraction, okay? So that because there's the stability of the mind is holding the object, it's having a strong memory of the object. So then mindfulness functions in a way to not forget the object. So you can really see why mindfulness is important at the beginning of your meditation. Because if you cultivate strong mindfulness, you know, there's a familiar object, you call it to mind in such a way that you don't forget it. So if your mindfulness is strong, then it's going to be very easy to generate good concentration from that. Okay, the first one was the objective feature, so it's an object that is familiar. For example, the breath, or we take time also to make ourselves familiarized with the image of the Buddha. And the second is the subjective feature, that it's an attitude of or an awareness of not forgetting the object within observing the object. So we're actively focusing on the object, okay, and not forgetting it. And that functions to eliminate distractions, to prevent distractions. Okay? So you can see at the beginning of the meditation why it's important to generate strong mindfulness. Right? And why mindfulness is sometimes called memory, but it doesn't mean memory in the same way as we usually talk about memory in English. Because mindfulness just isn't a recalling of something that happened in the past. You know, it isn't like some storage of information. That's not what some storage of dry past information. mindfulness is an active mental factor in which we are aware of something and holding that in mind in a way that doesn't forget it. Yeah?
It sounds like this is really talking about mindfulness is just turns meditation.
Right. No, I'm going to come to that. Okay, I'm just about to speak of that, how mindfulness comes in different categories. Okay, so in terms of meditation, it's just like I described. You know, it helps you to get your object to meditation and hold it there, and it causes concentration or single-pointedness to arrive. In terms of ethics and in terms of how we live our life, mindfulness holds in mind our ethical values and our precepts. Okay? So it doesn't mean that you're actively going around all day saying, I'm not going to kill, I'm not going to steal, I'm not going to have unwise sexual behavior, I'm not going to lie, I'm not going to drink toxic. It's not that you're going around saying those things, okay, like a mantra. But you're holding in mind, you are remembering that. Yeah? Your ethical values are in your mind. You're remembering them. You're aware of them. You know, whatever level of precepts you've taken or whatever determination you have to abandon, like the 10 destructive actions, you're able to hold that in your mind. You know what the 10 destructive actions are. And you can't be mindful of them if you don't know what they are. So you have them memorized. You know what they are. And then your mind, you know, you hold that in your mind. And then what you do is you use this other factor of introspective alertness, and it pops up from time to time to check to see if you're actually living according to your values, or if mind is, you know, running around the universe, you know, causing body and speech to do the same, doing something that isn't according to our own values. Okay? So in terms of ethical discipline and in terms of how we live our life, we're mindful of what we want to do and what we don't want to do, and then this other mental factor of introspective alertness pops up and sees, what are we really doing? Now, to get to answer your question, you know, nowadays mindfulness is just kind of used in the sense of, well, be aware what you're saying and thinking and feeling and doing. And I often use it in that way because that's kind of, you know, the very way we use it in Buddhism in America, of just be aware of what you're saying and thinking and feeling and doing. But that's not the real deep, lasting meaning of it, because just being aware of what we're saying and feeling and thinking and doing doesn't necessarily mean that we're engaging in anything worthwhile. You know, I can be completely mindful of telling somebody off and hurting their feelings. Yeah? So actually what mindfulness is meaning here is that we have in mind what our values are and our principles are, and those are in mind, and then we're using the introspective alertness to pop up and discriminate and determine if we're really following, you know, our heart, or if we're following our delusions, our disturbing attitude. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Like, yeah.
It can be any of the five or any of the six primary minds. But mindfulness has to be within
the mental. No. Mindfulness can also be, I mean, when you're just looking at an object with your eyes, you hold it. Well, you know. Not necessarily, because I think you can, I think this one must be able to arise with non-conceptual. I never thought about that, because it does say previous, but it could mean, you know, that you've known at the moment before. Yeah, like if you're looking at something, maybe you have some mindfulness at that time with your visual consciousness. The way I'm describing it is in terms of your mental consciousness. The way I'm applying it to the path is in terms of the mental consciousness. But I think it could probably arise in terms of...
How does the difference in attention and focus on the whole of the mind and the object without allowing it to
be aware
of the mindfulness,
Yeah. Yeah, they go very much together. I would think like the attention kind of get, well, the intention gets your mind near the object, the attention gets your mind on the object, and the mindfulness holds it there, and the concentration sticks it there. Okay? So they're all kind of related. Yeah? Yeah. So in all these mental factors, I think, you know, in any perception, there's lots of them coming in, and they're working back and forth in a network. Okay, so we talked about mindfulness in terms of meditation, mindfulness in terms of daily life, yeah, mindfulness in terms of our study. Here it allows us to remember what we learned. Okay, so when you go home and you think about what you heard in class, mindfulness is helping, you know, is the one that's remembering what you heard in class. And when you can't remember what you heard in class, that's, you know, the non-mindfulness. Yeah, the mental factor of spaced-outedness. Okay, and so also in daily life, mindfulness and memory allows us to remember what has been done and what we need to do. Okay, so just in practical ways, you know, it mindfulness knows, well, you know, here's my list of things I need to do, and I'm going to remember to do them, or I'm going to write them down like I do because I know I won't remember to do them. Okay. So one reason that alcohol is and intoxicants are really discouraged in the Buddhist path is because they obscure the mindfulness. You know, when we get intoxicated, you know, in terms of developing single-pointedness in meditation, very difficult, you know, when you're loaded to try and keep your mind single-pointedly on an object in meditation, very difficult. Yeah. In terms of keeping our ethical discipline, again, when we're loaded, very difficult, because the mind forgets our ethical values. It forgets the value and worth of keeping our precepts. It forgets what the 10 destructive actions are. Okay, and in terms of studying, then again, you know, when we're intoxicated, we can't remember what we studied either, and we can't remember what we said to other people. And so you can really see how, you know, why the precept about intoxicants is included in the 5 major precepts. You know, it's not that Buddha said intoxicants are bad and you can't get drunk. You know. I mean, Buddha's not being moralistic. There's a real reason for this. And when you see that, you know, the mental factors that are important to generate in our mind to gain realizations, and you see how intoxicating substances prevent the arisal of those mental factors, then we see the reason, you know, why Buddha gave that kind of guideline. I think this way of thinking is quite important. Otherwise, we see, you know, like the precept against intoxicants as, well, the Buddha's just being puritanical. And I'm saying this because so many people, you know, Buddhists in this country, have an incredible amount of difficulty with the precept about intoxicants. You know, there's all sorts of kind of bargaining going around about that, you know. Well, can I drink a little bit? And how about if we make the precept against intoxicant that you just don't get so loaded that you can't think? But a little bit is okay, you know? I mean, Americans want to bargain and do this. And some Buddhist teachers say that's okay. Yeah? But my teachers were very clear, you know, that you don't abuse alcohol, you don't abuse intoxicants until you use it. You know, first you use it, then you abuse it. If you don't use it, then there's no chance of the abuse, you know, going on. Okay. This is coming from somebody who did a fair share of intoxicants in her past. Previous life. Right, my previous life. Huh?
Something about
Carol Brown? Yeah. I did tell you that story. All of it. I didn't tell you everything I did when I was intoxicated. It was embarrassing.
Crimson.
I have some good stories to tell you what I did. One time when I was in Singapore, because the people there, I mean, they're just real sweet but very innocent in a certain way. And so I was telling some of the college students a little bit of what I did, you know. And one of them looked at me and he said, "Wow, Venerable, you sure changed." You know, he had this incredible appreciation for what the Dharma did to me. Okay, so, okay, mindfulness also works to help us remember what to practice and what to abandon. And this is a really key phrase, you know, you're going to hear it a lot in Buddhist studies, what to practice and what to abandon. And that this is something, we have to use our intelligence to discriminate it. Yeah? We have, our intelligence discriminates what to practice and what to abandon based on listening to the Buddha's teachings and thinking about them. And then our mindfulness holds that in mind so we remember, you know. Oh, we decided it was worthwhile to practice meditation every day, and we decided it was, you know, not worthwhile to swear at people, whatever it was. Okay, so this thing of being able to ascertain what's valuable to practice and to abandon, and then not just ascertain it, but to remember it, to hold it in our mind, so that it becomes kind of the framework or the filter through which we live our life. So instead of the filter of our life being, you know, my happiness and my ego and my well-being and me, I, you know, kind of the framework, the paradigm of our life becomes our values and our aspirations that are quite virtuous. So with mindfulness, we hold in our mind, you know, what we want to practice and what we want to abandon. And then the other mental factor of introspective alertness checks up to see if we're acting according to this. And then if introspective alertness finds that we aren't, then the other another mental factor called conscientiousness steps in. And conscientiousness is what cherishes what is virtuous. So conscientiousness, you know, says, okay, turn right, you know, get off this track, it's not going anywhere productive, and gets us back on track here. Okay? It's not listed as a separate one. Non-introspective alertness is listed under the 20 auxiliary disturbing attitudes. But actually, introspective alertness is an aspect of intelligence or of wisdom, which is one of the 5 object ascertaining minds. So like I said before, the 51 are not an exhaustive list. You know, there's many that are left out here. So, for example, they don't point out introspective alertness as a separate one, but it actually is, and it's quite important.
If you had mindfulness, you wouldn't need introspective
alertness. Yeah. Well, you need both of them together, because the mindfulness holds the object in such a way that you don't forget, and the introspective alertness checks up to see if you're on it or you're off it. So if introspective alertness, you know, checks up and sees, oh, I'm still concentrating, then you keep going on that way. And if introspective alertness finds that you're off in never-never land, then... So introspective alertness will see you've lost the mindfulness. It rings the burglar alarm. And then we generate some other mental factors, according to the situation, to get our mind back on the object and regenerate our mindfulness. Okay? So you see how these things work in tandem? How we need both of them? Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well,
it's
hanging out in this really kind of discreet way. They call in terms of like when we're trying to develop concentration, it's like a spy. So it just comes up in the mind, just kind of checks up. You know, what's going on there? Yeah. So it's not this, you know, real hard thing of, what am I thinking, you know? You're not driving ourselves nuts about it. It's just this one that kind of checks up, surveys the situation. So it's a very important one. It's very important. Because if we don't have introspective alertness, then if we lose our mindfulness, we're not aware that we've lost it. And so that's why, you know, you start to meditate, you watch two breaths, or you have the image of the Buddha for about 5 seconds, and then 10 minutes later the bell rings, and you go, oh, where was I? And the reason our mindfulness got lost, okay, but the reason we didn't get back to the object was because we had no introspective alertness that became aware that the mindfulness was lost. Okay? So you see, these have two different functions, but we need both of them. Okay, so also, another way of looking at introspective alertness, like I was just saying, it's an aspect of intelligence, so that helps us to distinguish, for example, a good motivation from a bad motivation, and then mindfulness keeps our mind fixed on the good motivation. And then conscientiousness reinforces this and cherishes the good motivation. Okay, so again, you see how all these different, they're all separate mental factors, but they all affect one another and help each other. Okay, so if we don't have alertness, then very often we practice things out of order, we do things incorrectly because we're not aware of what we're doing. If we lack mindfulness, then we also do things incorrectly, out of order, because it's not clear in our mind, we don't remember, you know, what to do. Yeah. So we start the meditation, we meditate completely backwards to front, you know, upside down, and then we wonder why nothing's happening. Okay. And actually, as you develop your mindfulness stronger, your introspective alertness automatically increases too. And as your introspective alertness increases, your mindfulness gets stronger. Okay? So they help each other. That's kind of what you were asking before. Okay? Questions about mindfulness? So it's quite interesting, you know, spend some time thinking about this, yeah. and really applying it to your life. Yeah. Be aware, you know, have the introspective alertness of what you're mindful of, and if you're mindful of the proper things. Okay? So try it in your meditation this week. You know, be really aware of mindfulness as you meditate and of introspective alertness to see if you're still on the object. And in your daily life, try and use the intelligence to, you know, discriminate what to practice and what to abandon, and then use mindfulness to hold that in your mind, and then use introspective alertness to see if you're still there. And so try and be really aware of that this week, you know, the interplay of these different things. Okay? Because when we're studying all these mental factors, this isn't some kind of abstract thing. This is describing what's going on in our mind. So, I mean, His Holiness always says the best laboratory is right in here. You know, we have our own laboratory here. So we take these things and apply them to what's going on. We look. Okay.